there are so many women out there that are taking a stand against gender inequality and are paving the way for the future generation. Ordinary women that are creating a more inclusive and powerful society, free from stereotypes, racism and sexism. And I'm here to share their stories with all of you. Stay tuned, because this is WEN Power, your source of inspiring, powerful and positive stories. And I'm here to discover how we can change the narrative, one story at a time. I am your host, Ilaria Biancacci, journalist and founder of WEN Power.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of WEN Power Podcast. This is the first one of 2024, and I couldn't have asked for a more inspirational guest to kickstart the year. I'm here today with Lisa Bascott. She's the founder of the Second Line of Defense, the UK first female-focused recruitment agency for the private security sector. This is going to be a very interesting episode, and with no further ado, let me introduce you to Lisa. Welcome, Lisa, to the WEN Power Podcast.
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much for having me, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to such a pleasure to have you with us today. I'm going to take you straight into this interview with a question that I like to ask to all my guests, and it is, what is that you fighting for today, Lisa?
Oh, yeah. So it's a big one. essentially, I'm fighting for the advancement of diversity and inclusivity within the industry sector that I represent, which is the private security industry. A lot of what I'm trying to champion within that industry reflects some of the wider issues and problems that we are experiencing in society today. So, for example, preventing violence against women and girls and marginalized groups, and making sure that they are looked after and properly represented, and also ensuring that as a community or within communities that we have safe communal spaces. And that can mean a car park, it can mean a park, a football terrace, a university campus. What we need to do is ensure that people like you and I, who are just going about their daily business, can feel as though they can walk the streets without fear of violence, of harassment, or any kind of violence. And it's really important. And all of this, for me, has stemmed from the murder of a woman called Sarah Everard that took place in March 2021. And that essentially changed the course of my life. Clapham happens to be my hometown. It's where I was born and bred. I now actually live in Brighton, but I recall nothing but a good, relatively feeling safe as a woman growing up in that town. And the idea that during a pandemic that someone in a position of authority was able to abuse their power to such a horrible extent and outcome shook me to my core, and I vowed at that point that I had to do something about it, which is the journey that I'm on at the moment, basically, and have been for the past sort of 18 months to 2 years.
Well, definitely this is a very important mission, and I'm happy to be here to amplify your story today and let everyone know what the amazing project you're working on and what motivates and what fuel your, you know, your passion and why you wake up every day to do what you do. And when I moved to London, I used to live in Clapham as well. And I remember it was still in my memory, one of the best places in London. And I believe that the death of Sarah really broke the heart of many women in London, and especially because, as you say, someone with an authority was the perpetrator. And you know, it's like you don't feel safe anymore in any of the streets of this city. And it's important what you're doing to help create spaces for us.
Absolutely. And it's really interesting because I've been a magistrate for coming up to 12 years now, and when that horrible event happened, and it was on the news, and you know, and I was visibly, you know, shaken by it. My then daughter said to me, and she's nearly 17, she said to me, "Mum, this is really hard. What would you say to me now if I said to you, I was walking along the street and I saw a police officer and he stopped me or was trying to stop me? What would I do? What should I do?" And at that time, I literally didn't know what to say to her. I couldn't, in my heart, say what I knew I should have been saying, which is, this is a position, a person in a position of authority. You can feel safe with them, you know, listen to them. But what I ended up saying to her, because I didn't want to lie, is go with your gut. You trust your instincts. And if for any reason you don't believe that the environment that you are in feels like the right one, you turn on your heels and you run in the opposite direction. I have never, ever in my life had to say that to someone, and I had to say that to my daughter, and it shook me and still does. And I still not 100% sure that I would give her any different advice based on what we have seen and heard over the last year or so about some of the issues that the, in particular, the Metropolitan Police is facing. Now, I am here to make sure that I can have a say in changing that. I do not want that to be my default position. However, an awful lot needs to change before I feel comfortable saying those words to my nearly 18-year-old daughter. So that's where we are. And that's the journey that, you know, and it's going to be a long one, but that's the journey, that's the path that I'm on. I need to see significant change. And I am putting my money where my mouth is. And I am doing everything in my power to be in a position of influence to make sure that that change happens, so that people like my daughter, like my goddaughter, like my friends' children can feel safe when they go out of an evening or in the day, right? This is what it's about, you know. As mothers, as brothers, as sisters, as aunties, as uncles, we want to ensure that our loved ones can go about their business without fear, right? This is what it's about. So that's the journey I'm on.
Well, thank you very much for sharing this. And I'm sure it's not an easy thing for a mother, but also for the position that you occupy in society with all your with your roles, with your business and your company. It's not definitely something that you would expect saying, as you say, to your daughter or to any young woman out there. You know, just you know, trust your gut. It's a worrying thought, and we shouldn't be having this right now in the
Exactly.
society we live in, but unfortunately it's still the reality for us women. And as I said before, it's really important that you are creating spaces and but also provoking conversation on this, because it's something that we really need to talk about and even bring more men on board with all this initiative, as we are not standing alone in this world. So we need the support from everyone.
Absolutely right.
I wanted to ask you to tell us a bit more about you. I read a lot about your story. We discussed about your experience in our previous conversation. So I do know a lot of things about you, but I want the audience that is listening to us to know to today to discover a little bit more about yourself. And you know, who is Lisa? What motivates you to wake up every day? And who inspired you while you were growing up?
Well, I said I had a conversation with someone before the end of last year, and it's really funny. It's quite straightforward for me. My sort of biggest role models, if you like, were my parents, but in particular my mother. Both my parents were Jamaican. They're both dead now, and they came to this country as part of the Windrush generation to better themselves, better their lives, and to have a different kind of outcome for their future children, essentially, of which I am that offspring. And my mum and dad were ambitious and they worked really, really hard. But my mum was most definitely the matriarch of the family. And she was quite stern. And she was really ambitious. And what she, you know, it was a double-edged sword, because what she wanted was to ensure that her offspring had all the advantages in life that she didn't necessarily have. And so she kind of ploughed it all into me. And I was a bright girl, and she recognized that immediately. So that there was a sort of an expectation about me and what I was going to become. And with so many West Indian parents, it was it's a profession, right? You're going to be a doctor or a lawyer or a this or a that. So there wasn't much scope for you know, deviating from that. And it was fine. So I ended up going off and doing a law degree. Not necessarily said it would have been my first choice, but I enjoyed it. I really had a good time. And I was on course to become a barrister. And I started down that route. And then I decided, actually, it's not what I want to do at all. And I had to pluck up the courage to tell my mum that actually it wasn't happening. She didn't speak to me for about 6 months, but it was the start of me asserting myself. I had a very strong sense of self, basically due to my mum in particular instilling that in me. But I remember thinking that, at the age of 18, 19, that actually, you know what? I'm going to start asserting my authority on my life, and I'll take responsibility for that. Thank you very much. And so that was the start of the process, and that was good. It was a good turning point for me. And I suppose I always knew that I wanted to do something in my life, whether on a professional or on a personal level, that was going to be of some sort of significance. I wanted to make my family proud, my parents proud. I wanted to make me proud, but I actually knew that my time on this planet wasn't just about me. And I knew that from the earliest of ages. It was about my wider community. And I've always had a strong sense of community. And again, being part of a West Indian community whereby, culture and heritage was really, really important. So, I'm first generation Black British. So for my parents, it was really important for me to understand about where they were coming from and their background and their culture. So that was a really, that formed me and my identity. And it made me feel quite bold, actually. I knew I had a really strong sense of self. And as I say, I always knew that my community was going to be important and giving back. And at that age, it was around that time, whilst I was at uni, I was going out with someone whose mother was a magistrate. And I remember going to visit her with him one weekend, and we went into town, and there was a young man who approached her, and he stopped her, and he said, "Oh, Mrs. Lee, you don't remember me, do you?" And she's only little, and she looked up at him and she said, "Actually, I do know you." And long story short, this is a young man that was before her in court many years ago, and he was from a family of, let's say, well-known individuals, and he was going down exactly the same path. And she basically sat him in the courtroom on that day. He was in for another misdemeanor, and she said to him, "Listen, look, I'm going to give you this one piece of advice. You're going down the same route as your uncles and your aunts and whatever. And good luck to you if that's what you want to do. But I see before me a guy who's bright and has a future, and it's up to you." So she basically just sort of said, "I don't want to see you in here again. I'm giving you this opportunity. I could do this with you, but I'm not going to do it." And off he went. And apparently, that conversation with that woman changed the course of his life. He walked out of that courtroom and he vowed never to walk back in again. And he changed his life around. He met someone, they had a child, and he, years later, remembered that woman. And when he saw her in town with us, he had to come and swear. And at that point, that's when I knew. At that point, this is what I need to do. This is my path. And that sense of community that I always had, all of a sudden, there was this role that I could put the two things together and go, right, I want to be able one day in my life for one person to feel that way about something that I've said or done to them. And so that was the beginning of me knowing that I wanted to be a magistrate. It took me until I was 45, or just under 45, to actually do it. Because obviously, what happened? I had life, I've been traveling, I had boyfriends, I got married, I had children. And the reason why I didn't commit until then was because I knew that once I committed to this thing, it was what I would be doing for life. I'm not half toe in, half toe out, I'm all in. And so nearly 12 years later, here I am in my role, doing what I do, enjoying the job, feeling humbled every day that I go into court to do what I do. But again, that sense of community is so deeply ingrained in me. I can't really explain it. It's everything that I do. It's who I am. It's part and parcel of what motivates me. So that's me, I suppose. That driving force, that kind of wanting, it's not about doing good. It's about being representative and giving voice to those people that don't have a voice. And just particularly for me, I wanted young black men and women when they came into a courtroom, not to think that they were going to get preferential treatment from me, but that they were going to be treated equally, fairly. And as we know in this system, the disproportionality, of people of color incarcerated, and particularly black young men, right? And then take that to the point when they walk through a courtroom and what they see generally, up until more recently, are three white faces, middle-aged, right, who know nothing about, have no idea about where they're coming from, unable to empathize with their background. I needed to redress that balance, essentially. So I want them to walk into the courtroom and go, right, here's a woman, and I might not be from the same background, socioeconomically, but I do empathize and I do understand what it is you're going through. It doesn't mean you're going to get treated any better, but you are going to walk in there feeling as though you are going to be treated equally. And that is a massive driving force for me, in life, but also within the role that I play within the magistracy.
Is the importance of representation, no? And
Absolutely.
if you cannot see it, you cannot be it. We talk about this so much. Sometimes it sounds more not empty as a sentence, but if you need to walk the talk, so you want to see more people like you represented. So what are you actually going to do about that? You cannot just sit back and relax and enjoy the view and feel like, oh yeah, it's just one more representation. But as you say, community is important, and giving back to the community, it is even more important. And to give a voice to those that cannot have it, they don't have a space, they are not listened to, it's tremendously important. And I think, it's a great force to have and a great motivation to get you out of bed every day, no?
No, absolutely. And as I said to people, I say it, and I say it not lightly. Outside of having my two children, it is the single most important thing I have ever done and continue to do in my life. And possibly the journey that I'm on now is coming to a close, you know what I mean? But outside of my children, it is the single most important thing that has driven me this past decade or so and continues to.
And also, I think we will discover more with other question after. Is that the what impressed me as well about your story is that you had a dream when you were younger, and it didn't necessarily came straight away. You had to go through different other careers and path and experience. You mentioned it as well. Traveling, just living your life as a young woman, and then when it was the time when you were ready, when you were capable of standing up to this mission, then the job and the opportunities came to you. And I think this is also the reason why in 2021 you became an SEIA licensed door supervisor. And it is also what led you to launch and found the second line of defense. Shall we talk about this
Yeah,
more,
no,
please?
absolutely. And it's really interesting that you talk about, we talk about life and life experience. And I've known along the way that certain things have been significant, significant sort of markers in my life. Divorce was one of them. That completely changes your perspective and means that you have to draw on resources that you don't even know whether you have the strength to do it, but you do. And it kind of, it's the making of you and can be the breaking of you, but it was the kind of making of me in a way, because it forced me to, at the age of 40 odd, to completely reevaluate my life with my two young children in it. And what does this mean for me? And I when I got to 2021, when I moved from London, relocated to Brighton, I was in a really good place. I was in a happy place. And I had no idea that this thing was going to be on the come on the horizon. And I keep referring to, when I talk to people about my journey, I refer to myself as an accidental activist. I did not choose this path. I absolutely genuinely believe that it has chosen me. I literally felt compelled to do what I'm doing. And so when I saw that news bulletin about this missing woman in my hometown, I knew that they were not going to find this person alive. But I didn't know at that point that it was going to change the course of life. And then I just remember feeling angry, really angry that still, 21st century, this stuff was still happening to women. But I think what was even more poignant for me was that this is not Sarah Everard wasn't the first, and she unfortunately will not be the last to be brutalized at the hands of mainly men. But for me, the difference was all of a sudden my children were of an age where it felt much more personal to me. In the past, when these things have happened, my children were babies, so I don't have to worry about them going out clubbing or, doing anything. I was protecting them, right? They were not leaving me. But when this happened to Sarah, my children were closer to the age of 18 than not. And as a mother, your sort of this protective instinct just came out of me. And I just remember thinking, whoa, 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 not on my watch, not on my watch. I have to. I brought these babies into the world, and I'll be damned if I'm not going to protect them. And I just was like, ugh, what am I going to do? So I remember sort of researching into, safeguarding, particularly within the nighttime economy and the sorts of people that do it. And it was then that I kind of learnt about the sort of massive shift, if you like, in the approach to safeguarding. It used to be our emergency services, the police, but basically through a number of reasons, austerity being one, they are no longer the people that if you're in trouble, that will, be coming to your rescue. It will be the people wearing a blue badge that says SIA on it, and they are frontline door supervisors. And when I looked into that industry sector, I thought, oh, okay, we're in trouble, right? This is an industry sector that had been regulated for 20 years. And in those 20 years, they'd issued over 400,000 licenses. And of those licenses, only 10% were women. So in 2021, we had a census, and that census said that 51% of the population looked like you and me. So I was like, let me get this right. So I go out, and my daughter goes out, and her friend, 90% of the time that she goes out, the people standing on the door have no relation to her whatsoever. They don't understand her journey. I mean, and this is the important bit, the actual journey that a woman or marginalized groups like the gay community, what they go through and what they have to subconsciously consider just to go out and have a drink, right? Male, men, they go out, put their jacket on, they're thinking about what pint they're going to have. We subliminally are thinking, is my phone charged up? Have I got a backup charger? Am I wearing the right kind of shoes? Oh my God, who's going to bother me when I walk to the bus stop? When I'm on the bus, am I going to get hassled? When I get to wherever I get into, am I going to get hassled by the person on the door? When I get into the bar, or is my drink going to get spiked? Who might I get touched up by someone? All of these things are incumbent on us, and we've been told as women that we need to sort of minimize ourselves. We need to do something about stopping predators doing us harm. And I'm like, no, this is nonsense. This has got to stop. And part of the conversation was with women as well, because up until the Me Too movement, we were quite happy, or we were very silent about this conditioning that had been happening since the day we were born, right? We just kind of accepted it. But I definitely saw a significant shift around 2016, 2017 with the Me Too movement. All of a sudden, it felt as though women, and again, this was spurred on, I particularly think, by the Gen Zs and the millennials going, you know what? We're going to use our mouths, and we're going to speak out about this, and we don't care. And it was, for me as an older generation woman, I was like, yes, come on, girl. Do you know what I mean? It was like, yes, this is right? This is absolutely right. And then coupled with, slightly further down the line, we had the social movement around the George Floyd killing. All of a sudden, I realized that there was something, there was a shift. There was something going on, and it was to do with this new cohort of young people deciding, understanding right from wrong and being able to articulate it in a way that made people want to listen, right? And I remember thinking, no, right, now is the time. I think there is an appetite to hear, to voice dissent, if you like, around all this nonsense that has been happening to women. And, you know, we don't have to sweep it under the carpet. And we need to talk to our young boys and our brothers and our sons about what is going on. And not, they can't get away with saying anymore, "Oh, well, we didn't know." No, we're telling you now, right? You're hearing about it now. You do not have an excuse anymore. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I understand why many men in the past would be like, you know, "We're not mind readers." Yeah. But now things have changed. And I want to exploit that mood change, that societal shift. And I don't ever want the dial to go back in the opposite direction. I am only interested in moving in one direction, and that is changing the cultural perspective around how men in particular perceive, not all men, but some men perceive and treat women and feel that they can do so. And for women to feel as though they are not being difficult by expressing these things. I want the world that my young son and daughter are going to be living in to be a different place. And as their mother, it is incumbent on me to do exactly what I need to do to start that process. Now, I can't do it on my own. I know that, but I do have a voice. And like you said, I don't want to be a naysayer moaning about things and then not doing anything about it. So that, you know, it's part and parcel of who I am. I often just kind of go right in there when I feel that there is injustice or that underdog over there needs the voice. I've always been that person to kind of just go in there, right? Afterwards, I just go in there and I wrap my arms around them and I say, "Come on, we can do this together." And I feel so strongly about the work that I'm doing within the private security space and wanting to help them transform themselves, because essentially what that industry needs to do is go through systemic change. This is as transformative. You know, they for 20 years have been behaving in a particular way because they've been allowed to, but times are changing, and the industry recognizes that people, you and I, the general public, we will not stand for this anymore, because everybody has a mother, a sister, a brother, an auntie, a best mate, a girlfriend, right? And they worry about them when they go out and about. And if the people at that frontline level are the ones who are going to be the make the difference between safeguarding someone, keeping them safe and not, then we need to have a say in the types of people that are going into that role. It is absolutely imperative. And this is why the conversation that I'm having with the industry is not just for the industry. I am wanting to have this conversation and take this conversation to our communities, right? I want mums and dads and brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts to be a part of this conversation, because it is everybody's problem, right? Keeping people safe in those environments, right? You know, communities, communal spaces is all our problem. And we cannot keep saying, "Oh, it's really bad, but I'm not going to do anything about it. Oh, it's really bad, but I'm not going to do anything about it." We've got to do something about it. So I've kind of recognized that I am going to be that voice, that sort of conscience on everybody's shoulder, the industry in particular, right? But also, I want to have a dialogue with communities about what they can do, the voice that they have to bring about change. You know, if you want this place to, if you want to go to Primark and shop without seeing some violence happening on the high street, do something about it. Speak, engage with your local MP, whatever, you can do something about it. And so I have positioned myself, you know, in my role with my business to bring that conversation to the nation, essentially. And it's, you know, I spent all of 2023 kind of speaking to people, building alliances, partnerships, and collaboration with people, because I know what I am trying to do is yay big, right?
It is indeed.
I can't do it on my own, right? I it's about last year was about finding those strategic alliances and those groups of people that can help me on that journey. And I am just one person. So it's about saying to that stakeholder, "Come with me on this journey. Use me. Let's do this together. And look, there are six other really major stakeholders who, together, if we get this conversation right, and we basically tackle what I believe are three key issues that straddle issues that are happening in society, but also have a very, very strong thread in terms of safeguarding and security. If we can get and build alliance and conversation around these three big topics, then I think we're going to get some way into moving the dial in the right direction, right? Changing behaviors. So, the first pillar I talked about is transformational change, systemic change within a frontline system of security that basically we as a general public, that is our first interaction with security. But it's everywhere, right? Sainsbury's, Primark, bars, restaurants, there's courthouses, hospitals, everywhere you go, they are wearing that badge. And so you need to know, as an individual, as a member of society, that these people are the right people, right? And we know within that industry, there is so much wrong going on within the industry sector. People aren't getting paid what they should be getting paid. The training is substandard, right? There are rogue organizations, exploiting people. We need to, living wage standards. We need to correct all of this because if we don't correct it, we're going to get people going into those roles who are not suitable, right? And then therefore, and it perpetuates the problem. But we need that industry sector to be a sector that people want to go and work in for all the right reasons. And we need to get that right. And then, as part of that journey, we need to be looking at these, for me, what brought me into this industry sector is absolutely private security, the role that they play in helping to prevent violence against women and girls and marginalized groups, right? So, having a better awareness and being more cognizant of the issues that those particular groups or particular people face, and we need to address them, but we need to do it in a sort of a joined up way. So there are lots of amazing organizations out there doing lots of different things, but what I'm not seeing is joined up conversation, right? Everybody's doing, 50 million. We need to get meaningful data, to get meaningful responses and initiatives set up. We need to have joined up conversations. And again, by being on certain steering groups and committees, I'm able to hear the conversation of some of these groups and pull them together. My ambition for the industry and for society is for us to eventually have a body that is one body that represents everything that goes on in the country, right? Rather than 50 million different initiatives going on, confusing people, and it's difficult to get momentum around something like that if it's so disparate, right? Organizations are more likely to kind of want to put their money into one big pot if they know it's going to help everyone, as opposed to 17 different ones. So it's about, that's a barrier for me. It's one that is I'm going to have to keep chipping away at. Because I think everybody likes the idea of being able to say that they've ticked that box, but I want them to kind of get over that and actually see a bigger picture. Like, what is it we're trying to solve? What's the problem we're trying to solve? All right, how can we do that together? And still tick the box in our respective sectors or whatever. But actually, if we're really going to make a change there, we have to start talking to each other. So that's huge for me. And as part of that initiative, I'm proud to have been invited by British Transport Police to work on their race action plan and their initiatives around preventing violence against women and girls. I'm also working, as you know, with Safer Business Network, and that community interest company is the brains behind WAVE and Ask for Angela training throughout London. And I again proud to be on the board, and as I say, I want to use my experience sitting in these groups, big pockets, to see what I can do to kind of bring the conversation around one table. And then I said the third for me is once we've so my dream is to have this transformed frontline, in particular private security industry sector, where the people doing that job are properly reflecting the people that they're serving within their communities, that they look like them. I want my daughter, when she goes off to uni and she's out with her mates, when she goes out on a night, she's going to see a collection of people on the door that actually represent the people that she's hanging out with, and that she, yeah, that's my ideal. That's my dream. That's what I'm working towards. And as part of that, I want her to be able to walk out with her friends, feeling safe, right? Feeling as though, there are things in place that will enable her to walk the streets of wherever she is, not having to look over her shoulder, right? That's the ultimate goal. And we've got a long way to go before we get there. But that's ultimately what I'm aiming for. And as part of that, the third pillar is about what we do as businesses, local authorities, whatever, to ensure that those spaces are as safe as they can be, right? What are we doing? So when, we are thinking about a new car park, let's have a little think about that car park with a woman in mind. Because I tell you what, for me, one of the places that I feel most unsafe of all the communal spaces in the country is a car park.
Me too. And
In
I
day
think
or night.
90% of people are listening to us today as well. It's a very
Day or
fun
night.
space.
Correct. And it's like, hang about. How is it that we are still building car parks that make women feel unsafe? Something's got to change. So local authorities, when you're giving your planning permission to an organisation to build a car park, they bloody well better show you plans that, that look like a space that someone is going to feel safe in. It doesn't matter that there might be cameras. It's they're oppressive spaces. I hate them. I absolutely hate them. And if I can at all, if I go to a car park and it has a top space, I go right to the top of the building where it's open, because I don't like to be. And that's ridiculous. I'm 54 years old. I shouldn't still be feeling this way, but it's because we're not doing anything about it. And in the same way, I'm a massive football fan. And I hear stories all the time about women feeling uncomfortable on their way to football matches in certain places. So, for example, Brighton and Hove, the football grounds are based in a place called Falmer, which is where Sussex University is. Now, it's the most depressing station ever because it's underground pathways, and no woman is going to want to walk there, right? No woman. So, I know lots of women who go to watch the football matches at Brighton. They take a long journey. So they avoid Falmer station. That's just ludicrous, right? You've got to start thinking about ways in which we can make these spaces inclusive for everyone, right? So there is a piece of legislation. Well, it's a bill, and we hope that it will be made law potentially this year, which is called Martin's Law. Now, there's an incredible woman called Feagan Murray who has been campaigning post the death of her son, Martin. And he was at the Manchester Arena, Ariana Grande concert, and he died. And she basically wants the government to bring in a piece of legislation which essentially says, like, all communal spaces, clubs, bars, whatever, need to have a basic level of safeguarding standards in place. All right. So if you're a club and you have 1,000 people at capacity, there must be a bare minimum in terms of safety standards that you have in place, right? Because you're a licensed premise and you have be, you know, and you're dealing with, communal safety. And it got a mention in the King's speech recently. So hopefully it means that we're on the right path. But it's about ways in which we can encourage businesses to see this as an opportunity, right? If you have safer spaces and you can show that and market that, then you're more likely to have my daughter and her friends wanting to go to your space because they know that they're going to go in there, that you've taken some kind of initiative around spiking of drinks, that you have no sort of dodgy dead spaces in your organization where dodgy things might be able to happen to them, that you know that your security staff are fit for purpose, right? And that they are diverse. And that they can handle the very diverse issues that happen in a space like that, from sexual assault to spiking to neurodiverse issues, you name it. Unfortunately, the people that are being trained today are not being trained in the things that they absolutely need to be trained on when they're standing on the doors. part of the conversation that I'm having with the regulator, this Security Industry Authority, the SIA. I mentioned the blue badge before. That's what's imprinted on it. It's about explaining to them that their training course that they set up 20 years ago in 2003 is not fit for purpose. What is happening in 2024 is light years away from what was happening in 2003. In the last 7 years, I mentioned to you before the Me Too movement and George Floyd. In that space alone, look how the world has changed. Look how
Exactly.
the world has changed. And what are we doing in this really important industry sector? What are we doing to reflect that? I say not enough.
No, too
Nowhere
little. It's not
near
enough.
enough. Nowhere near enough. So this is what's driving me. This is what is driving me. I have a vision for the industry sector and the world that we live in, our communities, that reflects those three pillars. Yeah. And everything that I am going to be doing going forward is about driving through those three initiatives and having this conversation on a national level to ensure that we are moving in the right direction. So it was clear, relatively clear to me a year ago, but having spent a year in the industry, it is razor sharp now. What needs to be done? Who needs to be involved, where I will go and get that help and that collaboration from. And now it's just a case of like, let's just get on with it now. Now I'm all about action, right? I've had to sort of rein myself in because I've kind of been sort of 15 years down the line and everybody else is trying to catch up. So I recognize that. So I've kind of reined myself in, brought myself back. But it's all about driving those three initiatives, having that national conversation around that transformative change within the frontline part of the industry sector, that massive nationwide conversation that everybody needs to be a part of around stopping violence against women and girls and marginalized groups, and also being a part of the conversation about the space that we live in, feeling comfortable, feeling safe. In those spaces, we need to open our voices and start saying, no, this, I don't, no, this is not good enough. I don't like this. And look, I keep saying to everyone, we are in an election year. There is no stronger voice that you can have than in this particular year. So, I say to people, you want things changed? First of all, you've got to open your mouth. You've got to be prepared to do something about it, whether it's just writing a letter to your MP or going to a local community group to have a discussion about change. But it's also the ballot box, right?
Yeah.
It's powerful. It's super powerful. I mean, I was absolutely proud of my daughter, who the very first thing she did when she turned 16 last year was register her interest to vote. And I was so proud. I didn't even know she had done it, but I almost cried when she proudly came in and she went, look, Mum, look. And I was just like, yes, this is what I mean. We start these conversations now with my daughter and my son, who are going to be our future leaders, our future beyond. If they understand the power of this at this point, then we're doing something right, but we've got to keep going. We've got to keep having that conversation. We can't be complacent. And
No.
that's if anything that I've known, I've learned in this last sort of 12 months is that, I've come across an awful lot of complacency. And that has been my biggest battle, if you like, kind of having that, and I'm not afraid of a difficult conversation. That's that. As I say, I think my 10-year history has built me up for this level of resilience now, because I will need to be resilient because it's going to be hard and there are going to be people who just don't want to go on that journey, right? They just don't want to do it, and that's what I have to build up my strength for. It's not the people like you and other people who get it, right? I don't want to preach to the converted. I need to have those difficult conversations, and I need the strength to have those difficult conversations, and I need to have the allyship to back me up when I'm having those difficult conversations. So that's what all of that work, all of that hard work into 2023 was all about, putting me in the very best position that I can be in this year to start driving through this initiative. And it is, it's huge, but why think small, right? If you're gonna do something, reach.
Everything that we bring a change is not small. It can't be small. And
Reach for
I,
the
yes, and I mean, the path you've chosen is definitely not an easy one.
stars.
I want to just say to the audience, 2024 is the year not to be a bystander anymore. So if you want to be involved with Lisa, if you want to help, if you just want to, have a difficult conversation or explore different topics, you can, we will share the details afterwards, but please get in touch with her because, as we said, for both of us, community is really important. The network that we build is our net worth. And we rely on opinions of people like you that are listening to us today. So no more bystanding in 2024. Just take action, please.
I love it. I love it.
And I know that you already covered this a bit, but for me is what is important, obviously, as Wempower mission is to bring the focus on women. So why women are so important in the security industry, and what do you think you can bring with your agency that obviously is already not out there? Because if you have created one, there is a gap, so we need that. But what are the particular things that women can bring to the conversation, to the job, to make this industry more inclusive and diverse?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, apart from anything, it stems back to the basic maths, basically. 51% of the population in this country are women. So we have a frontline security sector that is basically lacking, woefully lacking in representation when it comes to women. I have spoken in the time when I became a door supervisor and I worked on the doors in Brighton and Hove for just over a year and a half. And in that time, I specifically did that role because I needed to find out what it felt like to be a woman in that role and also have conversations with people, general public, other door supervisors, venue owners, paramedics, everyone, you name it, the police, about how a diverse and mixed security team is better to serve the communities in which we serve in, right? So everybody wants to see in themselves someone standing on the door, essentially. I want to know as a woman that if I have an issue within that group, that I will feel comfortable coming to someone in that establishment. Now, it's not to say that there aren't men who are not empathetic, but the bottom line is that the perception from the general public and from what you generally see on the doors is big black or big white bloke kind of looking a bit menacing and not very inviting. So if I get sexually assaulted in the club, it is less likely that I am going to want to come and have a conversation with you. And so what is happening in society, especially with young people, is that things like that are happening within establishments and they are being taken out of those establishments and taken home. Like not being dealt with, and it's just unacceptable, right? We need to have security teams that are representative, right? But the gender imbalance is so off, right? That is that's the glaringly obviously, and also women. We as I absolutely stand by this. We take a different approach to conflict, right? We are less combative. We are more likely to want to seek resolution. And we use our mouths, right? We use the art of listening and speaking to control situations. I think in the 18 months that I was doing that job, I don't think I put my hand on a person once. Or maybe I did to physically help them because they were so drunk to get them out there. But I didn't ever have to resort to physically. And that is part of my remit in that role. I can. As a last resort, if it means keeping an individual safe or other people safe, I can, with my colleague, eject someone. I've never had to do that. I've just spoken to them, right? And I often laugh and say I put my mum voice on. You raise your voice and you have a certain tone, and they're like that. But it's effective. But also, just having different perspectives in that role is important. So women are ultra observant. Why? And this is the depressing part. We are because we are on hyper alert, right? And
We
that's
have to
just
be. We have to be. It's a
instinctively. We are.
society that made us like that,
There we go.
unfortunately.
So when I'm standing on the door of a club and I'm assessing the queue, I can pick out nuances in a way that the men standing with me have no idea because they don't know what to look for. I can sense it. I can see agitation of a group of people, right? I can see it from way up there. So by the time it gets to me on the front door, I'm ready for it. Or I've already gone up the line to see what I can do to diffuse it before. Because at the end of the day, my role, I believe, in that role is to facilitate people having a good night out, not to keep them out, to facilitate them having a good night. Now, if by spotting something and walking up the line and talking it out before they get to the point where the big blokes on the door might want not want to, then I am doing my job. They will go in, they will have a good time, they will see that I care and that I've communicated with them, because this is what it's about. It's about communication, it's about empathy, and it's about recognizing that you're there to facilitate, not to be a bully and not to prevent people from going into an establishment. And I think women are well equipped to do that. But also just generally, there are so many roles, airports, women's refuges, certain other places where actually only a woman can actually physically assess the safety or well-being of another woman. Often mothers with children feel more comfortable going up to a woman or a space where there is at least a woman next to a man in that role, right? So there are so many reasons why, but the biggest is just underrepresentation. Full stop. You cannot have an industry sector underrepresenting 51% of the population. It's unacceptable. Me, without my security hat on as a mother, unacceptable. Right? I need that has to change. And for me, that's my personal goal. My personal target is to ensure that in the next few years, when my daughter is off at university or whatever she's doing there, it's going to be significantly different for her. I want that visible change to have happened. And that's not a difficult thing. And this is why all the conversations I'm having with those big security companies, the top 20 security companies in the country represent about 80% of that frontline offering. So if I can get them to commit and change that demo, that those numbers, then we're going some way to making a difference, right? Needs to be happening. Representation needs to be happening throughout the industry at all levels, but the significant one, the ones that materially affect people's lives in cities and towns and rural areas, is that frontline sector. We've got to make sure that they are representing the communities in which they serve, and those communities are made up of 51% of women. And it's just as simple as that. I mean, it really I don't really need to say anything more. It's just like it's not fit for purpose. It needs to be fit for purpose. So that for me is, as I say, is the driving message. And I just think as an industry sector, so much can be gained from getting women into these roles. Just as I say, just a completely different approach to the way in which we resolve conflict. Yeah, there is always going to be the need for force, for physicality. All right. And men have that over us. They definitely do. But it's that combination, it's that blending of these sort of perspectives that I think is what is needed. And I personally believe that as part of that change, we need to make venue owners much more directly responsible for the security teams that they bring in. At the moment, as a licensed organization, you just have to tick the box and get the company in. But the due diligence, right? Is that the right company? Are they truly representative? Are your customers happy with what they're doing? They don't get involved. And I'm like, actually, the licensing process needs to be a little bit more rigorous, I believe. So I'm having conversations with leaders of councils and saying, come on, why, what are you afraid of? If you're going to issue a license to that club to get a security company in, you need to stick some conditions onto that license, and you need to follow up with those conditions as well. And you say, right, I'm going to come and do a spot check and see how representative your security people are, or do a survey of your punters to see whether or not actually they are ticking the box and doing the job that they should be doing. We need to bring that much more in line, because at the moment, I believe that venues are getting away with not having to get involved. And I think there are an awful lot of security companies that out there that shouldn't be doing what they're doing. Full stop.
Yeah, and I think also when it comes to representation, we also need to be careful that it doesn't become like a token. Well, we got more women on, so we are more happy. Everyone is happy. We're getting maybe funding, or we're getting support, or the company is still open because it complies to the law that say, 50-50, a balance. So to also make sure, and I'm sure this is part of your agency as well, that women are not just thrown out there on this job with not a proper training, with not a proper support, because this is also what is important and what will make representation, diversity, and inclusion and the security force more effective, right?
Absolutely right, and it's so important, and it's all about part and parcel of that conversation is about ensuring that, as I as touched upon it earlier, that the security industry is seen as a go-to profession. It needs to clean itself up, right? We talked about all the sort of change that needs to be happened, and part of that change is ensuring that there are career pathways in there, right? So you come in at a certain level, but you can see that there is a pathway. Within this industry sector. So it's not about just sort of appealing or trying to appeal to people to come in and do that job and that job alone. It's yes, that's your entry level for most people, but it's about once they're in that entry level, where can they go afterwards? So it's about professionalizing that industry sector and making it fit for purpose and therefore making it attractive to women, because I wouldn't want a woman to go into that role if I thought that they were just going to be thrown in at the deep end, not cared about, not supported in any way. It's not what we want. We want the longevity for this industry. So we want to be sort of prepping ourselves for the next generation security leaders, right? And we need to make sure that they are culturally diverse, and that they have the skill sets that will be able to bring the sector forward for another generation. And that's what's really, really important.
And I think about maybe even that this might be a silly point, but I'm thinking about the uniforms or the workplace, because sometimes, we want to bring more diverse groups, minorities, people with disabilities, but then the workplace is not suited to accommodate their needs. Or I'm thinking about the uniforms as well, as women, obviously, but it's different. Even in terms of security, no, the vest, the boots, and everything. So even that has to be inclusive and diverse, so that is can be used and applied to all the workforce. And I think we are far away even for that, no?
Absolutely right, and it's a really, really important thing, because that still isn't, again, still is an issue. And the reason why it's an issue is because there's only 10% of those people out there are women, so therefore it doesn't really matter, says the industry. But when we change that, the women are like, no, you make uniforms that we have busts, right? We have busts, we have small waists, right? Some of us have butts, right? Whatever. But you need to ensure that the uniform is, you're standing in a position for maybe 8 to 12 hours in a day. Your boots, your everything needs to be comfortable, right? But everything that happens in this kind of this sort of environment is built around men, right? And big men. So women just seem to have to sort of fit in when they can. It shouldn't be about that. It's about accommodation, and it's about, as you say, being properly inclusive in every aspect of the role, every single aspect, and that includes uniform. And you'd be surprised just how important that is. Feeling physical, imagine putting something on and having to wear it for 12 hours and feeling uncomfortable all day. It's just unacceptable, right?
Of course, or having blister on your foot because the boots are not the correct size. And maybe this is a very particular field, obviously, because it requires uniforms and specific workload. Obviously, your work location is a club, so it's the club that will need to apply to a workplace that is suitable to your needs. But think about any other industry. Nothing is actually fitted for women. And as you say, we need to shrink in, we need to adapt, we need to make it work. And it's like the car park, like we talked about before, or you're a football fan, and even football teams, female football teams, sometimes they don't have tampons bins in the toilet of the places where they train and they play. So it's the old world that is not suited for women. And I don't know you. I mean, I think so, but I'm a bit tired that we always have to, squeeze in and try to find our place. That place should be there already available for us.
Yeah, and that's why I am more than happy to be that person shouting from the rooftops for in particular for women. And again, sort of places like football stadia, really important conversations to be having with them about the little things that they can do to make the space that they're operating in much more inclusive for people. Really little things. And those conversations are starting, Safer Business Network through the Ask for Angela program has basically gotten every single London Premiership club to sign up to pledging that they kind of stand behind the initiative. But that's just the first step. There are so many more things that these are rich, rich clubs. Money is not an option. These people, it's not that they don't have the money, but it's about getting into their psyche, making them understand from this perspective what things look like. They might think, oh, well, we do this. No, actually, you come and journey in my boots and see it from my eyes, and then you might have a slightly different view about that. So it's about getting these prominent businesses, to get on board with this journey, to show their allegiance and show initiatives and partner with the likes of people like the Safer Business Network or whatever, to show that they are doing everything that they can within their sector to combat all of these issues that we're talking about. Yeah.
I have a few last questions for you to wrap up this conversation because there's much more we can share, and unfortunately we don't have all the time of the world for us as Lisa's very busy and but we talk about community, and I have a question that I really want to ask you, and it's you wearing a lot of hats. We didn't even mention all of them in this interview. You will discover more as after we publish it. But it's obviously for us that the focus on community and sustainability, diversity is very important for you. So what advice do you have for all those people that are listening to us right now, and maybe they are seeking to balance multiple responsibility and pursue different interests? What would what would you share with them?
I'd say if you've been thinking about wanting to get involved with something, stop putting it off. Literally, just go on. I mean, there are so many places that you can do. You can go onto LinkedIn, you can use Instagram, you can use all sorts of places to find out where groups gather to have discussions around issues that are pertinent to you. But I always say, start close to home, right? And start small. I think the thing that overwhelms people when it comes to sort of getting involved is, oh my God, that is such a big thing. What am I going to do about it? What difference will it make? Every little bit that everybody does builds up to make this big difference. So I say always start locally. So, if locally for me is Brighton and Hove, and there is a particular thing that I'm interested in, whether it's sport or children or whatever, then see what you can do. Your local chamber of commerce is also a really good place to start with finding out who does what, where, and how you can get involved. And also, if you have issues, you have your member of parliament, you live in a constituency, and you have a representative for your constituency in Parliament. And actually, the first thing that you can do is get onto your laptop or onto a computer and just draft a letter and just say, hi, Sue. Hi, John, local MP. I have a concern about this. Can you please tell me what your party are doing about this? What initiatives have taken place over the last 10 years? X, Y, and Z. I want to be able to do X, Y, and Z. Point me in the right direction. That's your first step. I always say, start right on your doorstep. Don't worry about what's happening next door or down the road. But where you live and you breathe, because you have a perspective on that, right? Whether it's taking your child to school of a morning, going to your local post office, going to your corner shop, going to your local town hall, you have a perspective on the place in the place that you live in. And you are best, there's no one better than you to share that, right? And
Yeah.
you have a voice, and you're allowed to, right? You're allowed to. So I say, just like you said, no more procrastination, no more putting off tomorrow what you can do today, and start small. Start small, whether that is at your local school, or lo local community center, or wherever. But say something, do something. Yeah.
This, another word came to my mind, and it's engagement, no? Because community, and what just after what you say now is like engage with the conversation, whether if it's just maybe you join a group and that's it, and that's what you can do with your time, with your commitment, and but just do it, take the first step. And also to all maybe the business owners or women that are listening to us that are thinking, oh, I would like to create a business. Sometimes we look for idea in crazy places, and as you demonstrated with your story, the idea is much more closer to your heart, to yourself, to your lived experience than what you actually think. Like in your case, it's your safety of your kids that drove you into this new chapter of your life. In my case, was the experience I had as a young journalist. For another woman, could be her lived experience, and this is what motivates us and what is going to help us to make a change, even if it's small. You know, at least we are doing something about it. So don't be scared.
I totally 100% echo that. That is
Yeah.
absolutely, and it has to, you're right. And the reason why it needs to come from here is because that's where the authenticity is. That's the place of it's truth, right? It's real. It's truth. And no one can mess with your truth. Your truth is your truth. And so act on it. Act on it. You feel it in your gut. Do something about it, because I guarantee you there are about 15 other people feeling that too. And then you connect with those 15 other people, you're powerful. You're really powerful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you had to choose a word to describe your 2023, what would that be?
Roller coaster.
Okay.
Right, it was empowering. It was definitely a roller coaster journey. Just like it was just and but it was enriching, enlightening, but it was empowering. It was empowering because it was, I suppose, for me, it was kind of almost sort of make or break. I threw myself out there. No one knew who I was in the industry on the 1st of January, but I felt that compulsion. I talk about it before, that thing that was driving me was driving me. It was driving me. And I didn't, I kind of threw myself out there, and I didn't care whether or not anyone, what anyone had to say about me, because I knew that I was coming from a place of authenticity. I went and did that training course for a reason. I didn't stop there. I then took myself off, stood on the doors in the cold, in the wet, in the whatever, whilst being a magistrate. There were times where I'd finish at 5 o'clock in the morning, come home, have a few coffee, and then get and sit on the bench in court, right? It was driving me. And when you're coming from that place of true authenticity, no one can tell you that you haven't got something to say that's worth listening to. It's your story, it's my story, right? But I recognize that this is a story that resonates with many, many people. But I'm telling my story, and I'm on my journey, and I want to bring as many people along with me as I possibly can. But I can only tell the story from my perspective.
Of course.
Hope that it enriches and enlightens people, so that they can kind of, it stimulates to possibly do something themselves. That's it.
Exactly.
All I can ask for.
And January, you know, is the month of writing down New Year resolution, New Year, New Me vision boards. Do you have a word for 2024 or what you hope for this new year?
I suppose, well, I don't know whether it's just one word. I mean, definitely this year is more action, but action in a different way. So 2023 was, if you like, almost about authenticating myself in a space, getting my voice out there, making people understand what it is that is driving me and what it is I am trying to achieve. And 2024 is about action. It's about implementation, and it's about spreading the word, right? But physically getting out there. So, this year is about putting on this a curator. I've curated an event, which is an event which discusses those three pillars that I talked about as a framework, and to have a discussion with the rest of the country. So I want to take this conversation to every major city in the country over the next coming years, so that we can have a national conversation about ways in which we can change the world in which we live in. And that is absolutely what's driving me. So the first event hopefully will be taking place in Brighton and Hove within a few months' time, and that will set the, if you like, the framework for the other events that will take place across the country. So yeah, it's hard. It's going to be, I thought last year was hard. This is going to be hard. It's going to be tough.
No, I look, by listening to you, you have so much passion and energy, and I don't know, I feel very energized and motivated by this conversation already. So I hope we have empowered at least one woman out there with your story. And Wempower is going to be here to follow your journey in 2024. That's a promise. That's one of my resolution for this year. And my takeaway from this conversation is to, really, community is important. Your network is important. We are not alone in this daily fights that we decided to embark on, and we need to leverage these connections, the power of community around us, because this is what, I don't know for you, but for me, it's also what motivates me and makes me think like, okay, I'm gonna wake up today because at least I'm going to share another woman's story, and that will empower another woman out there. So let's keep
Absolutely.
doing what we're doing. And
I'll definitely
to a
do
new year filled of challenges,
it.
adventures,
Yes.
connections, and action.
And just keep talking, keep connecting. It's really important. And I think what you're doing is incredible. And I think there's so much synergy between what you're doing, what I'm doing. There are so many amazing, amazing people out there. And yeah, I just say to everyone, anyone who wishes to contact me to have a chat about what it is I'm doing or anything that they think that they can participate in on this journey, I am open. You know, this is an inclusive conversation and an inclusive journey. So bring on 2024, that's what I say.
So to conclude, we started with a question: is what you're fighting for, and in one sentence, is what you wish to stop fighting for.
I wish to stop fighting for preventing violence against women and girls. Full stop.
Full stop.
Yeah.
And for all the people that listen to us today to this amazing conversation, if they want to get in touch with you because they decided not to be a bystander anymore in 2024, how can they do that?
You can go to my website, which is www.second2nd. lineofdefense.com. You can find me on Instagram, Second Line of Defense. You can find me on LinkedIn, Second Line of Defense, or under Lisa Vascott. Please reach out to me. Please let me know of anything that you think, you know, resonates with what I'm doing within your local communities, because I want to be a part of that too. I want to be a part of your conversation.
Amazing. Thank you so much again, Lisa, for being with us today.
Thank you for having
And
me. Brilliant.
again, Happy New Year.
You too, you too. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
If this was your first time listening to Wempower Podcast, thank you for taking the time. You can find us on Podbean and Spotify. Subscribe to our newsletter on wempower.co and keep up to date with all the future projects on all our social media at Wempower UK. Thank you to all the women out there that are following and supporting Wempower. I will continue to bring to you powerful, inspiring, and positive stories from all over the world. Don't forget, together we empower women. This is Ilaria for Wempower Podcast. Until next time.